Welcome to Conservation Federation, Episode 2. I'm Brandon Butler, the host of Conservation Federation and the Executive Director of the Conservation Federation of Missouri. Today we're recording in Montgomery, Alabama, at the headquarters of the Alabama Wildlife Federation. I'm here attending the Affiliate Chiefs meeting of the National Wildlife Federation, and I'm joined right now by Colin O'Mara, the CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. So for many of our listeners, they hear that CFM is affiliated to the National Wildlife Federation, but they might not be very aware of what the National Wildlife Federation is. So could you please explain it?
Sure. So the National Wildlife Federation is America's largest wildlife conservation organization, founded back in 1936 when I think a lot of sportsmen and other conservationists across the country realized that the wildlife that we cared about was disappearing off the landscape. And some of it was from illegal commercial hunting. Some of it was from habitat loss. I mean, you had the Dust Bowl, you had the loss of forests, loss of wetlands. And this group was basically founded in response to that. President Franklin Roosevelt invited conservationists from across the country to come to Washington, D.C. to talk about how we had better scientific management, better dedicated funding for wildlife, better education. And at the end of the meeting, rather than just having a conference that everyone went back home on their cars or on their trains, they said, like, let's actually organize. And so for the past 80 years, we've been working together closely with conservation organizations across the country and predominantly sportsman organizations across the country, like the Conservation Federation of Missouri, that then serve as state-level federations and bringing together different partners. And so we have almost 6 million members between the national members, the affiliate members, the different kinds of supporters. And this is everything from hunters and anglers, and there's a couple million of them, as well as backyard gardeners and folks that like to hike or paddle or just go out and birdwatch or whatever it is. So it's folks of all walks of life from all political parties coming together for conservation.
The relationship between NWF and CFM really goes back to the beginning. Ding Darling was instrumental in the founding of NWF. He was also at the founding meeting of CFM the year before. He must have got bored at our meeting. He drew a sketch on a tablecloth that actually hangs in my office. But, it's been a long, long relationship, 80 years, and it seems to be going strong really right now. And I'm excited about the direction that NWF's going.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is exciting is that during that period in the mid-30s, you actually saw a lot of these organizations coming together, whether it's the Federation of Missouri. Aldo Leopold was at the same time was working in New Mexico, starting the Federation there. And I think it was those experiences that were somewhat formative, saying, look, if we have great state-level kind of federations of different at that point, Ducks Unlimited is kind of just being born in those couple of years. Audubon societies were maybe 20, 30 years old. You had the Boone and Crockett Club at that point, which is really only 100 members. And so some states had members, some states didn't. But it was a place that basically said we need to get all those individual rod and reel clubs or hunt clubs together in a common federation for common purpose. And I do think that even though he did maybe draw on that tablecloth, that I think the lessons that he took from that saying, hey, if we can do it in Missouri, we can do it nationally.
One thing that we talk about often is the complexity of the federation. CFM and NWF are in the same boat in the sense that your name doesn't exactly define all that you do. You talk about Ducks Unlimited just a second ago, and when you ask somebody what does Ducks Unlimited do, it's pretty easy to tell. Same with National Wild Turkey Federation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. But what the National Wildlife Federation does, much like CFM, is very diverse. Wildlife advocacy is a big part of that. And a lot of people right now are wondering what the future is going to hold on the political front for conservation. You're very in tune with what's going on in Washington, D.C. and all across the country. Can you just elaborate on what you expect or how you feel we're going to do in the next 4 years?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because the election of 2016 was not a referendum on conservation. It was not a referendum on issues like clean water or clean air or even climate. And in the places that had ballot measures, that conservation was actually on the ballot, it did extremely well. I mean, I think the best example is the incredible work that CFM and your partners did in Missouri with the sales tax referendum, which passed with 80%, more than 80%, which is an absolute blowout. And had support from the farming community and from the conservation community and sportsman groups and great corporate partners like Bass Pro Shops. And so the places that conservation was actually voted on, whether that's in the form of kind of pure land conservation like and restoration like the Parks and Soils Initiative and ballot measure in Missouri, or things even like, there's a solar measure in Florida, there is a wildlife trafficking issue in Oregon. These places they all passed overwhelmingly. And so we're working right now with the Trump transition team trying to make the case that during the campaign, Mr. Trump made a lot of commitments to sportsmen. He talked about keeping public lands public. He talked about increasing hunting and fishing opportunities. He talked about clean water. He talked about having abundant wildlife populations. And these are things that are obviously very near and dear to his heart because of his sons, who are great sportsmen, members of the Boone and Crockett Club. And so we're working right now to try to say, okay, well, the language is one thing, but what that means and what it means in practice is going to be important. And there is a bit of a battle right now on the right for the soul of the kind of the party's conservation ethic. And in a lot of ways, I mean, the conservation ethic we think of in this country has just amazingly strong roots in the Republican Party. And it goes back to President Lincoln setting up the land-grant institutions and setting up some of the first, you know, national, what became the first national parks, you know, President Grant going up through President Roosevelt and President Theodore Roosevelt, kind of the greatest conservation president. And even through Eisenhower, I mean, like, if you look at, and then into Nixon, you know, kind of signing the Clean Water Act and creating EPA. And so there's been this just incredible legacy of conservation in the Republican Party historically. Yet at the same time, you have forces within the party today, some of whom would like to sell off all the public lands, divest them either the states or private industry, more for ideological purposes than anything. I mean, at the same time, those are the places that, you know, the vast majority of hunters and anglers enjoy. I mean, they don't have access to private lands. And so one of the things we're working on is that if you want to be a sportsman president, if you want to be a conservation president, you have to kind of keep public lands public, but we also got to manage them better. We got to have better access. We got to have better habitat restoration. We can't have 60% of the Forest Service budget going to fighting fires. We need to be doing actual restoration. And so having those kind of things. So I think on those kind of issues, things like dedicated wildlife funding, things like proactive conservation, things like, you know, collaborative restoration efforts, I think we're going to see a lot of progress. I think there are some areas where we're going to disagree a little bit. And I think we'll, you know, have some good conversations within the Federation family. I don't think that we can achieve all of our conservation goals strictly through kind of voluntary collaborative efforts. I think there are some things like, you know, the Clean Water Act that's done amazing work getting, you know, reducing point source pollution into waterways. That's, you know, so important to fish health or to aquatic species. And so, you know, things like defending the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act is going to be important. And so what we're trying to figure out is what are those places we can absolutely work together and make great progress, work in hand in glove, and what are those places where hopefully we'll have some access and have some ability to maybe change some minds. If not, then we'll battle it out where we have to. But I'm not nearly as pessimistic as a lot of other folks. I think some great things can happen in the next few years for conservation because, frankly, we can't afford to have 4 years off. Like, there's too many challenges right now in the landscape. You're looking at, you know, disease issues, privatization issues. I mean, there's just a lot going on right now, and we have to be engaged. And, you know, we'll work where we can, and we'll fight where we have to, and hopefully we'll make some really big gains for conservation in the years to come.
One of the things you touched on earlier was the sportsman involvement in the founding of the National Wildlife Federation. Over time, I think the National Wildlife Federation in some sportsmen's minds got away from real sportsman issues. But now you're working really hard to bring that back. I'm proud to be involved in the Sportsman's Caucus for the National Wildlife Federation, and I see the work that you're doing and appreciate it. We really need to work on getting that message out that there's so much more to being a sportsman than just hunting and fishing. It's caring about the habitat, caring about the species, caring about non-game species. What do you think the future of the sportsman connection to the National Wildlife Federation is, and how are you going to continue to improve that mindset in sportsmen across America?
For me, the sportsmen are at the heart in many ways of conservation. I mean, if it wasn't for, you know, sportsmen coming together in the 1930s to, as part of the National Wildlife Federation, the Boone and Crockett Club and others, to pass Pittman-Robertson to actually create the dedicated funding and kind of the birth of the North American model of wildlife conservation, if it wasn't for that, we would not have seen the huge gains we've seen over the past 80 years. With things like, you know, white-tailed deer populations going up 40-fold, or, you know, wild turkeys being back in the landscape, or elk populations being back at healthy levels, or bighorn sheep increasing 5-fold. I mean, we've had almost 10-fold. I mean, we've seen massive gains for the things that we hunt and fish. And I think one of the things that I'm focused on is making that case, saying, look, where we have invested strategically and we partner with state agencies and we've kind of done proactive conservation work, we've seen that conservation investments work. We've seen great recovery of most of these species. At the same time, there's a whole lot of things that don't have that same level of funding. So, you know, one of the things we're focused on right now, working with a lot of partners like the Congressional Sportsman Foundation and the Boone and Crockett Club and Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever and the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership and Rocky Mountain Elk and so many others, is making sure there's enough funding for the full diversity of wildlife. And this gets back to the point that you were making at the beginning, which is, I think George Thornton, my buddy at Wild Turkey Federation, says it best, like, if you save the habitat, save the hunt, right? Like, it doesn't get much of that. Like, if there isn't habitat, if there isn't conservation, there is no outdoor recreation. And so we have to have that completely linked. I think the folks that are, you know, spending time in blinds or in stands know that kind of instinctively. They don't necessarily know that they are paying for it. And I think that when we don't make those investments, I think a lot of times they don't see the consequences of that. And so, I mean, I do think that there's a generation of sportsmen right now that don't realize the vital role that they play, that they're standing on the shoulders of giants that have come before, but there's a lot more investment to be made. And I think, you know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking of is it's great to have all the individual organizations focus on their slice of the habitat environment, right? And I'm really tight with the head of Pheasants Forever, Howard Vinson, who's focusing on grassland habitats, you know, for ringnecks up in the Dakotas, and guys like Dale Hall at Ducks Unlimited, who's an amazing conservationist, focused on wetlands and the prairie potholes and the central flyway. But we need to think about the system as a whole. And one thing I think that the Federation can do uniquely is bring together folks to think about how these systems interface with each other and thinking through how do we work together where it's I don't want people choosing between healthy forests or healthy wetlands or healthy grasslands. We need all three. And if we do that well, and healthy watersheds kind of connecting them all, if we do that well, the full diversity of wildlife, whether you want to hunt or fish or bird, is all available to all of us. And I think that's one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about, which is in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when the conservation community was much more unified, where the sportsman groups and the more green groups and the land trust and things like that were all working together, amazing things got done. As the community kind of fractured in the 70s and 80s, there weren't that many wins. And I think conservation suffered because of it. And it's not because of lack of effort. I think it's a lack of coordination. So I'm so excited about the work that you guys are doing at CFM. Because if we can show that you can kind of build these big tents around kind of big conservation priorities, we can begin to hopefully shed some of the baggage of the past and actually get big conservation victories again at scale. Because given the scale of the challenge we're facing, we need solutions that are up to the magnitude of the challenge.
One of my biggest frustrations is just how unengaged most sportsmen are. If you look at it statistically, in Missouri we have 1.3 million unique fishing licenses sold each year, 520,000 unique deer hunting licenses. Yeah, we're the largest conservation organization in the state, and we have 5,000 members. You know, statistics show that less than 1% of deer hunters actually belong to a conservation organization. And you just named a number of great ones, Ducks Unlimited, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Now, those magazines that they're putting out through those organizations are full of conservation content. But if you're not a member of one of those organizations, and you're just buying magazines or watching television on the Outdoor Channel, on their Sportsman's Channel, you're not getting very much conservation content. What you're being subjected to is really more marketing of products and opportunities to pursue trophy animals. And that's changing the tide of the entire sportsman mentality. And we have to do a lot to change that. And how we educate sportsmen to the fact that they have to get engaged, that's what keeps me up at night.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think you have two challenges simultaneously. One is making sure we're increasing the number of folks that are engaging in these activities at all. And we've all seen, you know, hunting licenses go down. I mean, I don't know the specifics from Missouri, but nationally, the decline is pretty serious. So there's recruitment, there's retention, and we have the 3 hours we have to focus on. And at the same time, we aren't seeing the same level of engagement. Some of it's kind of a broader kind of societal shift away from organizations, more towards social media and kind of retreating to your suburban house instead of kind of engaging in the local community. But we need to figure out a way to get these folks engaged. I mean, they buy their license, they are contributing a little towards it, but we're not doing enough to kind of reach a lot of them. And I mean, I'm a huge fan of quality deer management. I think QDMA, I think Brian does a fabulous job. I think they're exceptionally scientific based. They've done a great job getting on the science. You have 20 million, you know, white-tailed deer in the country. I don't know, you got at least a couple million folks with licenses. And yet, you know, again, I mean, how they get out to that reach that many people, when we know that when folks engage with QDMA, they're much less likely to want to participate in things like, you know, captive hunts or, you know, kind of canned hunts, and, you know, and they're much more aware of things like chronic wasting disease. I think those are the kind of connective tissue pieces that we're missing as a community right now, because we're only getting a fraction. Even as powerful as an organization like the National Wildlife Federation or Ducks Unlimited or Rocky Mountain Elk or pheasants or turkeys, we're only reaching a small fraction of the total number. And I think maybe some of that's shifting kind of away from membership models to different forms of engagement. Maybe some of that's more virtual and kind of social instead of just the magazines and the banquets. I mean, there's different thoughts on it. But, you know, I'm not convinced the average 30-year-old hunter that maybe took a few years off as they're maybe starting a family and they're not getting back into it, that the thing, oh, okay, after I get my license, the next thing I should do is sign up for CFM, sign up for QDMA, sign up for DU or whatever. And I think we got to figure out a way to make that connection much tighter, because the benefits are huge. The collective benefits are even bigger. The individual benefits are big and the collective benefits are even bigger. But it's going to take more work and thinking about how we engage with folks today and not necessarily use the models we used 40 years ago.
You asked about the license sales in Missouri, and we actually lead the nation in recruitment and retention. And that's a great thing, but a lot of it has to do with funding. Most people know that Missouri has a unique funding model. We're able to get our messages out. I worked for a while for the Department of Natural Resources in Indiana as a staff writer for the Conservation magazine over there. It's a great magazine. It has a subscriber base of about 12,000. The Missouri Conservationist goes out to over 500,000 households in Missouri for free. The magazine is able to serve as a vehicle to educate Missourians about all the benefits of conservation work and what the department is doing and what you need to do to be engaged. They don't have that in Indiana nor any other state. The funding is extremely important, and you just participated in a very important panel, the Blue Ribbon Panel, along with Johnny Morris and many other great conservationists from across the country. Tell us a little bit about the Blue Ribbon Panel and what we hope the outcome is.
The goal of the panel was to try to figure out how to have sufficient resources at the state level to do proactive conservation at scale to kind of bring back the habitat we need, both for the sake of increasing species health and increasing species population numbers, but also to avoid some of the restrictive regulatory issues that come when species are in trouble, I mean, with the Endangered Species Act, which was always intended to be a last resort. It was never supposed to be kind of the first tool that's being used, except now we're seeing like a lot of litigation leading to massive restrictions in the landscape, leading to questioning of the act itself in some quarters of the political realm. And I think the choice of having Johnny, who's a, you know, a hero of mine and a close friend, leading the panel made perfect sense, because in Missouri you have that perfect storm. And I know, I'm sure there's challenges. I'm sure folks listening that don't always feel like that. In the show me state, but you have dedicated funding, which as a former state secretary, you know, I was always envious of. You have great corporate partners that are engaged. I mean, there's no better conservation organization in the country on the corporate side than Bass Pro Shops. You've had good bipartisan support on these issues that really transcends party, and, you know, whether that's, you know, governors like Carnahan or Nixon or hopefully your incoming governor as well. But these issues have been fairly bipartisan, and you have an active engagement, as you're saying, you know, at least stable, if not growing, user base, and, you know, having the resources to put out, you know, good material. That is the exception. I mean, I hope some folks realize that how lucky they are to live in Missouri. I mean, it is God's country in a lot of ways. A lot of other states would die to have the level of resource, level of engagement. But at the same time, I think there's more opportunities for involvement on the policy side. You know, I mean, the fact that, you know, CFM and others had to, you know, kind of go to the mat a few years ago to defeat the transfer of regulatory responsibility for captive deer moving from the Department of Conservation into the Ag Department is a fight that every white-tailed deer hunter in the state should have stood up and been a part of. Yet, you know, a very few number of organizations were standing up with Johnny standing shoulder to shoulder with y'all. I mean, those are the kind of dynamics we have to shift if we're going to keep and maintain our conservation heritage.
Well, unfortunately, that legislation is back this year. Senator Munslinger wasted no time with this new administration in filing a bill that included everything he's ever wanted for the captive industry. We're expecting quite a fight this year, as we have a ballot initiative filed with the Secretary of State to put an end to that practice once and for all, but we'll talk about that more in a little bit. Well, Colin, you started at National Wildlife Federation about the same time I started at CFM. And I know how much travel I put in around the state of Missouri. I put over 70,000 miles on a pickup truck, but you've put over probably a million miles on airlines. You've been to 50 states in the last 3 years, or under 3 years. As you go around America, what are some of the issues you see states facing collectively? And then what are some of the issues you see states facing individually or regionally?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and you know, I've visited, you know, all 50 states, all the territories, you know, on my way through the second loop now. I mean, the biggest issue I'm seeing everywhere is just relevance. There's so many issues right now facing states, and the budget situations are so bad. There's so many competing priorities, and I think with the sportsman voice in particular maybe not being as unified at the state level a lot of places, like just staying part of the conversation and not getting like rolled by a captive deer industry or some other priority is a challenge. What I'm seeing is it's less so about individual fights. I think actually folks are pretty good at gearing up when there's a clear battle to be had, whether that's, you know, a funding proposal or something with, you know, improving scientific wildlife management or something trying to get kids outdoors. I mean, when those battles come up, we tend to do pretty well. And like when funding measures on the ballot, we do well. It's the day-to-day vigilance that I think we struggle at and nationwide. And it can take, you know, weeks to win that one big victory. But a lot of times in a lot of these processes, you know, it can take minutes to have something snuck in somewhere that undoes years of good work. And I think, you know, trying to figure out how we actually build up, I use NATO, and I grew up in a military family, and so I use NATO analogies a lot. I mean, how do you have that collective defense, right? How do you, and so like kind of an attack on one is attack on all. So if there's something going on that's going to hurt elk, like, you know, I want the turkey guys showing up, I want the pheasant guys showing up, I want us showing up, I want DU showing up, that we're standing shoulder to shoulder as a community, and that, you know, the places that are doing this well right now, and I'll use Michigan as an example, and Tennessee. Those are, you know, you got Dan Eichinger at MUCC, the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, and Mike Butler, who runs the Tennessee Wildlife Federation. They're pulling the broader community together, you know, several times a year. And they're setting joint priorities. And I know you're doing a lot of that in Missouri as well. It's amazing what happens, the power that can be kind of aggregated when you actually have that coordination up front. So rather than looking like a bunch of fools arguing with each other in a committee hearing or on the floor, or even worse, you know, during a legislative fight, actually, you know, having set priorities. And, you know, the places that are getting fee increases done, the places that are getting, you know, good investments in habitat or land conservation, places that are getting kind of good conservation fundamentals right, are places that are organized and places that are coordinated. And so, I mean, right now, I mean, across the landscape, I'm seeing a lot of attacks on access. You know, the public lands fights out west, stream access issues in a whole bunch of states. Folks just basically trying to privatize the public trust resources. And so, and it takes a different, the faces are different in different places, but the philosophical fight where, you know, and for me, it's almost a fundamental attack on democracy because, you know, we moved away from an approach to wildlife conservation where all the wildlife was owned by the crown, right? I mean, it was given by the crown to citizens as opposed to owned by the people. You know, we have a, you know, 200 year history of having kind of shared public trust resources, and there's people trying to infringe upon that every single day in different ways. And so I think that's one big one that's right at the top of the list. I am concerned about we got habitat loss. It takes different forms in different places. And so there's things we got to focus on there. But I mean, I really spend a lot of time trying to figure out how do we talk about these issues that, you know, we all learned about when we were reading the writings of Leopold or of Darling or, you know, of Roosevelt. But we need to be able to make them relevant today so folks understand what could be lost. And I think there's a lot of things that folks take for granted that with just a few small changes, right? I mean, you know, and we'll use the amazing battle you guys waged on the captive deer issue. I mean, if that white-tailed deer is no longer treated like wildlife, but is treated like livestock, you fundamentally change the relationship between citizens and their natural resources. And it's just, I think those are the fights that are not sexy. They don't show up on the front page of the paper. They're not going to lead in the evening news. But once you lose it, I mean, the challenge to change it back is almost impossible. And I think that's where I'm seeing just unevenness across the country, because you win in, you know, Missouri because there's a good, you know, kind of goal line stand, if you will. But, you know, in North Carolina, they got rolled, you know, they won the battle twice, and the third time, kind of on, you know, third and goal, they got rolled there. And in West Virginia, the state agency stood up, and then the state agency director got fired for doing the right thing, and then they rolled it there. You know, we've seen, you know, kind of good wins in Kentucky, you know, kind of mixed court decisions in Indiana. It's a state-by-state kind of battle, and I think we're not, again, using this NATO analogy, we need to be thinking not just at coordinating kind of NATO at the state level, but also kind of doing a better job connecting across the region, because each of the attacks are a little different, but the models for success are very similar. And I think that's what kind of keeps me up at night right now, because I think some of this stuff is fairly insidious, and we're not as well-funded, because it's not, you know, there's no profit motive on our side. We're basically just trying to protect the resources we love. And having the resources to be able to do this work well, state by state, and learning from each other has got to be a higher priority than it has been.
And again, I think it comes back to educating the average sportsman. You talk to a guy that lives in Indiana who wants to go out to Colorado and elk hunt on public land. He has no idea that there's this assault on public lands in Colorado. He doesn't understand the fact that these lands could be closed and taken away, and that dream of going out there and setting up a wall tent and living deep in the wilderness for a week, that might not exist in the future. And it's a PR motive that is just sweeping across the country with organizations like the American Lands Council. You hear the American Lands Council and you think, sounds like a great organization. They probably care about lands in America. They don't. They're trying to take lands away from you and I and the average citizen across the state. But that same guy who lives in Indiana and wants to go to Colorado, he can probably tell you what turkey call Michael Waddell uses or what gun the duck commanders use. But he doesn't understand the issues at hand that are going to affect not maybe him, but his children and his grandchildren and generations to come after that. And it's this awareness that we have to be better at, that we have to find ways to reach those people and make them care, make them understand that not only the heritage of our outdoor sports are under assault, but the future is just bleak if people don't stand up and rise up and join together in a united voice to stop these assaults by big money special interests that's trying to stomp out these rights of the average citizen.
Well, and I think, look, there's a lot of different driving forces at the same time. And, you know, we can sing Woody Guthrie songs until we're, you know, blue in the face. But, you know, kind of democracy only works if there's a vigilant citizenry, right? And so if there's money interests that are interested in privatizing access or doing more on the extraction side rather than on the habitat side and the recreation side, we need that kind of standing army, that conservation army that, you know, I often talk about as a way to actually provide that equal and opposing force. And I think your example of the, you know, the Missouri elk hunter being a good one when he goes across, one of the things that scares me is that there's a, I don't know what you want to call it, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways, where if you, you know, kind of block access in different places, maybe through, like, you know, county level actions, so you make it harder and harder for folks to manage the resource. And at the same time, you're starving the land management agency so they don't have the resource to do good habitat work. And at the same time, folks for a variety of reasons, are litigating every kind of restoration plan. So you're seeing kind of paralysis there, and you're not seeing enough restoration work. So the habitat quality degrades. Maybe you're not seeing enough work on infrastructure, you know, trails or other kinds of access points, or even just basic access points, backcountry or whatever. And all of a sudden, then folks begin asking the question, saying, well, couldn't these be managed better if they were under some either state control or private control? Where the answer, you know, for me, resoundingly has to be, we have to keep the public trust resources in public hands, but we have to manage them better. It means more collaboration, less litigation, more engagement of folks on the ground. But this is timely stuff. I mean, this can't just be the weekend warrior that shows up first day of deer hunting season, and you know, if he gets a tag for whatever, and that's the only time he engages with the resource. It actually takes a lot more time than that.
And I think conservation at its root is misunderstood by a lot of sportsmen as well. I mean, conservation is wise use of the resources. I think that gets confused with preservation. People think you start talking about conservation and you're talking about making sure that nothing changes, that animals aren't harvested. But that's not it at all. It's the continuation of the use of these resources in a wise way and to make sure that we do no harm so the resources exist for generations to come. And that includes industry, and that includes agriculture, that includes hunting and fishing. There's no conservation organization out there that's trying to close these lands off from people being able to utilize them wisely.
There's a great statue of Theodore Roosevelt on Theodore Roosevelt Island in Washington, D.C., and there's different statements, and one of them is about conservation. And there's a line that kind of talks about conservation actually meaning some level of development. And a lot of folks that go there actually misunderstand what he's talking about, because they're thinking about it in terms of like housing development or kind of business development. But what he meant was this sustainable, wise use and really kind of thinking through. And this is where I get frustrated, because over the last 40 years, we see these massive pendulum swings. We go from, you know, clear cutting of the 70s, and then we have this kind of backlash. We're going to create a whole bunch of like you know, regulatory barriers to avoid that behavior, but then we make it very easy to litigate on everything. So then you see paralysis, you see this other extreme on the preservation side, where there's a happy medium, right? We want you know, small diameter trees, you know, being taken out, you know, because we want to have decent habitat, whether it's for turkeys or for elk or for, you know, for grouse. We want to have managed, kind of actively managed habitat at scale. And, you know, and the other thing that, you know, I'm very concerned about, particularly out west, is that when you don't have active management of these resources and you have trees dying, you have, you know, more kind of tinder in the kind of firebox, if you will, when those fires start, they burn hotter, longer, and bigger than before. And so you end up losing all the habitat, right? And, you know, eventually get the kind of the early successional stuff to grow back. But, you know, these are the kind of conversations, and it's more sophisticated than just watching some TV show. But the thing that I think is incumbent upon, you know, folks like us and organizations like CFM working with state agencies is actually instilling that conservation ethic, because in a lot of cases it's not being passed down from father to son, because, you know, there's a lot of folks at our age, I mean, we're pretty close in age. You know, the only experience duck hunting was playing Nintendo when they were growing up, because they weren't in the blind with their dad. And so, you know, how do we bring those experiences to the next generation if they don't have, in some cases, going back two generations, maybe grandpa is the one that can teach them. But, you know, I learned by doing, right? I learned from mentors. I'm sure you did as well. And I think, you know, if you don't have that, then you don't have that ethic that then is so critical to understanding the full breadth and depth of what it means to be a conservationist.
One thing that I find is a lot of opinions are not rooted in facts. People just make up their own mind that things are what they perceive them to be, and perception is definitely not always reality. And forestry is a great example. You brought up forestry, and we see this in Missouri a lot, where the Department of Conservation is actually doing some clear cutting, and people are up in arms about clear cutting. We've got other forestry organizations that are doing selective harvest. Both have advantages. Both are necessary for a good ecosystem, good for industry. I have a house built out of lumber. I drive a car that burns gas. So to think that industry can't exist and both wildlife and industry can thrive is a mistake. Back to forestry, you know, historically fire took care of that undergrowth and those small diameter trees. And today we've stamped out most of wildfires, at least purposeful wildfires. We have to rely on industry to improve that habitat for wildlife.
Yeah, and I think those are good examples. And some fires, obviously, natural, and that's always, you know, that's always helpful to have those kind of natural burns to rejuvenate the systems. What we're seeing now is kind of more than that, kind of in a different landscape now. And I think there's so few folks that are actually interacting with the landscape on a daily basis that are, you know, spending time. And a lot of folks that don't hunt, right? I mean, they don't understand that. If I'm in a duck blind, I've been out entire days. I was out a day maybe a month ago. I was out in Idaho. Took one shot the entire morning, right? But it was just a beautiful day. We're just in communing with nature. And I think folks don't, if they don't appreciate that, then all of a sudden, like, the idea of having active management for wildlife habitat and trying to optimize across, you know, habitat outcomes, maybe, you know, some additional harvest for creating some jobs, having some bird feed, also trying to to improve watershed health, also trying to basically trying to have four or five different outcomes being optimized in a thoughtful way, is exactly what Roosevelt and Leopold and others had in mind. And that's a way to actually achieve multiple public outcomes at the same time. We lose that conversation when you got folks on one side that basically just say, you know, save it all, don't touch it, you know, look, but don't touch, and folks on the other side saying, well, let's just exploit the entire thing. There's so much ground in between there, but we're in a political system right now where so often that the political debate is defined by the extremes as opposed to folks that are just trying to make the system be in balance so our kids and our grandkids and their grandkids can actually enjoy the same treasures we've grew up with.
Another big issue that can't be avoided is climate change. The Federation's been involved in it for quite a while now. It's something that everybody talks about, but few people truly understand. There's arguments over if it's real. If it is real, why is it happening? We had a president in Obama who was very supportive of climate change initiatives, and now Trump is, he's backing up a little bit maybe, but he's still been identified as a climate change denier. You've been real close to the issue, and you know exactly how it affects wildlife. What are your overall thoughts on climate change and where we're going in the future?
You know, when I'm out fly fishing or, you know, out hunting different places, I mean, folks know the landscape's changing, right? Folks can talk about whether that's different invasive species that they're seeing or kind of temperature zones changing or kind of seasons slightly shifting or, you know, different plant ranges kind of shifting north or south, depending on the species. So folks know things are changing. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that was made over the past 15 years, I think, was two things. One was related to climate. The first was the frame when people started talking about it was entirely global. And so, you know, it's polar bears and puffins and ice caps, and it was very inaccessible to a lot of people, as opposed to talking about, hey, that trout stream is too warm now, or that the pine bark beetle, you know, kind of infestation we're seeing is, you know, destroying the tree stand. It was inaccessible to a lot of people, or irrelevant to a lot of people. And the second piece is that I think the science is very clear. I mean, I'm very good friends with some of the leading climate scientists in the world. And there's also a lot of alarmism that comes from something. Not everything that happens is 100% connected to climate. The modeling shows that we will have higher temperatures, we will have more extreme storms, we will have, you know, different kind of phenomenon as you're having more energy in the system. But not every single storm is 100% attributable to it. And so the problem is that when you overhype things, a lot of it was good and well-intentioned. I think it was actually to try to get people more concerned about taking action. But it leads to a level of cynicism among folks that are still trying to figure out exactly what they think. And so one of the things that I try to do is kind of take the rhetoric down a little bit and say, you know, what are you seeing? What are you seeing on the ground? And if, you know, you're seeing warming waters, or you're seeing, you know, less snowpack, meaning, you know, kind of lower water levels, or you're seeing these droughts, or you're seeing these fires, like, how do we manage those issues? And kind of talking about the habitat values, I mean, one of the things that I think is vastly underappreciated is the role of, like, forest fires and land clearing in actually increasing emissions. I mean, those are some of the best ways to reduce emissions is, you know, having healthy forests and having kind of abundant grasslands. And when you lose those lands, you lose those carbon sinks. And, you know, and those are things that in some cases are, if you regulated every refinery under traditional EPA rules, you know, you maybe reduce, you know, 20 million metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. If you manage our forests better, so you could probably reduce emissions from forest fires by 50 to 100 million acres. And so, you know, we get a better conservation outcome. That could be a bipartisan solution. Folks might want to manage it because they want to have better community safety or better wildlife outcomes or better watershed health or better, more board feet. That's a different solution. And I think we didn't focus on the things that are the most bipartisan to kind of make progress. I don't think you can regulate your way to achieving this. I think there has to be more community buy-in. And this idea that the solutions all can come from Washington, I think, is ludicrous. And so, you know, I think we got to go local. And I think, you know, I can talk to the most conservative, you know, Tea Party members in very, very states that overwhelmingly voted for the president-elect that know things are changing. They want to take action. They don't want the solutions dictated from Washington. And so, you know, that's great. If folks want to take action locally, that's fine. And I think this one-size-fits-all, you know, kind of approach that a lot of, you know, kind of environmental groups push, it's counterproductive to the point of folks actually digging in against action, which is going to, in the long term, hurt us. So
one thing that's really impressive about this meeting that we're having right now, we have conservation leaders from not only across America, but in the Caribbean. And there's two gentlemen here, one from the Virgin Islands, who was talking about climate change today. And it is different. It is localized when you're in the Caribbean, when you're on an island and watching land disappear underneath a rising ocean, than it is in central Missouri or in Montana. It's just, as you said, it's what do people understand based on what they're experiencing in their own backyard or in their own area. And to hear this gentleman speaking about the fact that places he used to stand, now there's fish swimming there, that really drives it home.
Yeah, and I think there's a million of those examples, right? And I think, you know, I had a chance to work for Senator McCain when he ran for president the first time, and he used to say, look, He said, we all can agree we want cleaner air, we all want cleaner water, you know, we want a healthy economy. He said, if I can propose solutions that achieve all those things, even if I'm not 100% sure that every single amount of carbon going in the atmosphere is kind of changing the climate, he's like, that's a home run for everybody. And I think as a federation, I think if we're just honest about, hey, this is where we're seeing impact, and then prioritize those things where there's areas of agreement, I think a lot of the solutions, especially over the next 4 years, we're seeing less focus on EPA regulations, maybe even, you know, walking back some of the regulations, which, you know, I have concerns about, but if that's the direction, we'll have to defend our core values. But at the same time, there's a lot of progress that can be made on other sides. And the issues in one part of the country might be more about resilience and kind of restoring wetlands that are being lost at an alarming rate right now in Louisiana, or somewhere else that might be trying to, you know, reduce the amount of acres of grassland we're losing because we're growing too much corn for fuel right now. We're putting it into our tank and gunking up everything instead of protecting habitat for pheasants. I mean, like, this conversation can be very, very different. The solutions can be very different. I just think we've got to be honest about the science and then focus on solutions instead of this ideological war that both sides have been engaged in.
We had a great session today on diversity, and that's another word that I think is oversimplified. People think diversity and they think black, white, Hispanic, but diversity is so much broader, so much grander than that. Diversity is socioeconomic, diversity is political party, diversity is race, gender, age. There's so much to it. So when you start breaking down these segments of populations across the country, diversified is truly what we are. But each of those also has different points of emphasis that they want to see focused on, and different areas of conservation that matters more to them than others. How do you see this incredibly diverse country coming together for top-level issues, the funding issues, making sure our wildlife and our areas remain in public trust, just all the different issues across these very diverse demographics coming together in a coalition?
It's a great question, because after the election, I think a lot of folks are trying to figure out, well, what do the results mean? I mean, are we truly as divided as maybe the polls would suggest? And I actually don't think the answer is yes to that. I think there's, you know, different views on the role of government and kind of the success, kind of how strong the economy is and things like that. But of all the issues that are out there right now, and, you know, folks will talk a lot about immigration, they'll talk about trade, they'll talk about you know, infrastructure, they'll talk about healthcare, these huge issues. And there's a lot of disagreement on all those, with the one exception in that list of infrastructure. But conservation is one of those issues that if it's positioned the right way, everybody's in favor of. Now, folks might want a more voluntary approach or more collaborative approach, maybe less, you know, regulatory or litigious approach, a matter of different, like, nuances about the means. But very few folks would disagree on the ends. And so one of the things that I'm focused on right now is, you know, how do we find those issues that really could transcend politics right now, where, you know, if you're a inner city African-American mom with a couple kids, you're concerned about the drinking water, you're concerned about your kids, like, air quality, you're concerned about recreational opportunities, you're concerned about having a good school. How do you make sure that person's needs and kind of what they're focused on intersects with the rural family that's maybe pretty far from a hospital, that they're, you know, working the land and they're not getting into much, it's commodity prices, they're getting trashed. And how do we find those intersections? And the things that come to the top of the list are things like having clean water, having, you know, decent air quality, having abundant wildlife. And this gets back to relevance and kind of like salience of these issues, that if we put it in the realm of the relevant to you know, families that are frankly just trying to figure out how to put food on the table and get their kid through school and hoping that their kid's going to have a better opportunity than they had growing up, and not seen as some like liberal kind of affect from, you know, kind of the intelligentsia that's kind of telling everybody else how to live. I mean, if we can actually say, look, this is just about your quality of life, that if we have clean water and clean air, your productivity is going to go up. There's more business opportunities. I mean, if you have a good outdoor economy, there's millions of jobs and billions of dollars of investment. I mean, I think... Right now, I think there's a lot of folks that are hurting, right? The economic recovery in this country has been very uneven. I mean, trade has affected folks very differently. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, and a lot of the companies that my friend's parents, you know, worked at are no longer there, and their kids moved away over when I was growing up. And so, you know, being relevant in that conversation, and I had an old mentor in Syracuse who was an old mayor, and he said, you know what? He said, people say they vote on all big kind of big things, but he said at the end of the day, it comes down to three things, three different circles. He said, it's the 50 feet around somebody's house. Is it safe? Is the house kind of decent value? Is it safe? The second is 50 feet around the kid's school. Is the kid going to learn? Is he going to get a good education so he can do better than his parents? And then the third, is their place of work secure? Are they going to have a job? Are they going to be able to pay for it? If you can win in those buckets, my friend the mayor, you know, would say you can win anywhere. I think we have to ask ourselves as a conservation community, are we relevant in those three buckets? Are we relevant at the dinner table? Are we relevant in the schools? Are we relevant in business? And if we are, then, you know, how do we work with those partners in those kind of spaces to make sure that our priorities are ways that we strengthen the economy, that we create economic opportunity, that we improve the quality of life? And if we do that, then all of a sudden we're not a Republican or a Democratic issue. We're just an American value because folks just want to be able to go out and hunt or look at the birds.
I grew up in a very interesting part of the world, basically South Chicago, Northwest Indiana, right on the shore of Lake Michigan. Once one of the most thriving economies in America, now an absolute ghost town. Grew up in a construction family. My father's business had contracts on government housing. Spent time throughout my teenage years in housing projects, tearing out old carpet, helping put new carpet in. Seeing a level of poverty that most people will never witness with their own eyes. And recognizing at a young age that I live 10 miles away from here, but it might as well be another world. I mean, the advantages that I had growing up where I had lakes and woods and rivers compared to being close to the Calumet River that at one time could actually be lit on fire. I recognize the fact that many Americans are never going to fish, they're never going to hunt, they're never going to be dedicated to conservation the way you and I are. But they want clean water, they want clean air, they deserve all of that. They should look to government to help make sure that all of that is top priority. I mean, look at what we've experienced in Flint. Look at the water sources in Lake Erie that I know you've been a part of. When it comes to those high-level conversations about just the basics of life, water, air, land that's healthy to grow crops that are healthy, what are those conversations like in Washington? I mean, are they recognized by everybody that this has to be a top priority?
I mean, it's such an obvious question that the answer should just be a resounding yes, but the answer is not always, right? I mean, I think in a world where the news cycles are, you know, coming at you fast and furious, there's kind of the initial outrage, and then we have kind of collective amnesia fairly quickly. I use Flint as an example. I mean, most of your listeners right now, I'm assuming, remember the Flint story and remember that they saw the, you know, tens of thousands of folks that couldn't drink the water and hearing stories about folks having to bathe their kids with bottled water or prepare meals with bottled water. 2 years after we knew it was a problem, it's still a crisis. Congress has still not acted. I mean, we're hoping they're going to act the next day or a half, but like, there's a package that, I mean, we're talking right now on a Wednesday before the session's going to end, but there's about a 30% chance that this package could blow up and Flint might get no help from this Congress, and which is just unconscionable. I mean, if this was in our backyard, I mean, we'd be screaming bloody murder. And so, you know, I think rhetorically there is. I mean, it's almost impossible when, you know, 98% of Americans or 96% of Americans support clean water and the other four just aren't paying attention. You know, it's hard to be against this stuff rhetorically, but then, you know, action matters. And, like, you know, words, you know, talk is cheap. And so I think one of the things that I'm focused on a lot is how do we, you know, kind of raise the profile of these issues to the point where you have to act. Because, you know, I like your example of kind of what you saw with, you know, kind of growing up. I have similar examples where, I mean, I grew up in a very, you know, kind of blue-collar community in Syracuse, New York, and, you know, a lot of families moved away when the jobs went away, or, you know, a lot of folks struggled. And I taught in a school where all the kids that got kicked out of all the schools went to, and had a chance to kind of experience some things that I hadn't experienced, a similar, you know, 10 miles, 15 miles away when I was growing up. And I don't want to sound too academic, but there's kind of this Maslow's hierarchy, if you will, of needs, right? Where, like, you know, basic health, basic, you know, food, clean water, basic security. I mean, if those needs aren't met, you can't kind of get to the higher levels of human development. But healthy natural resources are in the central of all those, right? I mean, if you can't breathe the air and you can't drink the water, you can't work. I mean, you can't provide for your family. I mean, there's all kinds of issues that come from that. And I think, you know, at a very basic level, we would be better served in some cases in losing some of the jargon of conservation, which I think is elegant and it's been developed so well over you know, generations. But keeping it simple about, you know, everyone in the U.S. should have confidence when they turn on their tap that the water is safe to drink. And there's a huge chunk of Americans that don't have that right now, including some folks in Missouri. And I think, you know, until we have that basic level of, I don't know what the right word is. I mean, until we have that basic level of, you know, kind of political will to make sure that the least among us are still going to have these basic natural resource benefits. I mean, until we have that as a national priority, I think we're going to continue to see the lack of investment and these kind of issues be pushed to the side as other issues take the forefront. But, like, you know, if every angler in the country, you know, stood up and said, you know, we want clean water, not just in the streams and lakes that we fish in, but we want things to be drinkable, swimmable, we want, you know, clean water. And that's a huge message, but we haven't done enough, and I haven't done enough personally. I mean, I think it's one of my my shortcomings is making sure we're transcending the boundaries from the rural, you know, kind of the resource into the urban interface, and making sure that that's seen as all part of the same ecosystem. It's the same, you know, kind of healthy watershed, as opposed to urban versus kind of suburban or exurban.
It's just taken for granted. It's something that people expect to be able to do, but once it becomes changed, once you can't go to the tap and just drink the water or go outside and breathe the air, there's parts of this world where neither of those things are available to residents now. If you go to third world countries, you can't drink the water. There's people that have to wear masks outside just to breathe every day. And people think that it'll never get to that point in America, but we're laying the groundwork now for not just a decade from now, but we're talking centuries from now.
I get questioned a lot because I talk a lot about the need to invest in America's infrastructure. And the reason I do is that there's a wildlife touch point. I mean, if you have stronger cities, you have less pressure on suburban development, you have less pressure on kind of resources. But it's also the way to ensure that folks have those basic natural resource rights. I mean, if you have good, healthy infrastructure, you have less pollution, right? You have healthier water coming through pipes. You don't have lead leaching out. I mean, there's all these benefits that affect natural resources, affect the things we care about. If you do good upstream restoration, you don't need to do as much filtration and kind of treatment on the back end. I mean, there's these systems that kind of work. And I think sometimes in our world, we make it so complicated. And I mean, a good analogy is, you know, if you think about all the steps you have to go through right now, if you want to hunt for the first time, right? I mean, and I'm not saying you should, I mean, everyone should have to go through hunter safety. Everyone should have to go through, you know, kind of understanding kind of the rules and making sure that everything's safe. But there's a lot of moving pieces there. And so in some ways, as much as I want to focus on increasing those opportunities for folks, I want to make sure that basic, you know, kind of clean air, clean water, those basics are there. And then once you're at that level, then take them for those great outdoor experiences that then could change your life for a lifetime. But, you know, I mean, I'll talk to parents sometimes and say, look, like, I'm worried about my kid, like, not getting through, like, second or third grade. I can't even think about getting him to go see Lake Erie or getting him to go see, getting him to see the White River, right? I mean, like, it's so far outside of the realm of the possible that if we don't find ways to engage them and kind of meet them where they are, it's going to be very hard to engage them as part of a bigger conservation army.
And we do need to make it easier for people to engage. A really cool story, quickly, that I experienced at CFM was we had a meeting of some of our more environmental-based groups. And a guy came in, and he drew a picture of a guy that doesn't look like he's going to be a hunter, and that was this guy. And we've since become great friends. So if you're listening, Mark, I was surprised. And he says, Brandon, I want to talk to you after this meeting. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I don't have any idea what he wants to talk to me about. But we go in my office, which is looks like one of Roosevelt's museums. I mean, it's just full of animals that I've taken over the years. And he says, I'm very interested in where my food comes from. And I'd like to start hunting, but I have no idea how to even begin. And this is a guy in his late 20s. I was just blown away by that. We, again, talked about diversity and stereotypes today, and I definitely had stereotyped this guy as somebody that wasn't going to be a hunter, wasn't interested in hunting. But we see opportunities to engage people through experiences like this. And I took him turkey hunting, and we had a great time. We didn't get a turkey, but a coyote snuck in to about 10 yards on us. And it was just a magical experience for him. And I don't know if he's continued hunting on his own yet, but just being able to offer people the opportunity. And programs exist, but it really comes down to individual efforts and one person giving to another person the experience to learn and to be in nature and see the advantages of being able to harvest your own food and take home a deer, take home a rabbit or a duck or a squirrel and say, I know exactly where this came from.
That first experience, whether it's fishing or hunting, is transformative. And I think it's sad in some ways that we have gotten, that so many Americans have gotten away from that, because I am seeing like a lot of young folks across the country, kind of the local vor movement, if you will, talking about the kind of wanting to know where their food is from, making sure it's healthy. And you know, a lot of times there's nothing healthier than, you know, kind of game animals, and really making sure that those experiences are available to folks. And I think what's nice in your example with your friend Mark is that if he didn't feel comfortable to ask that question, there's a good chance he never would have had that experience. And I don't know if you took the coyote or not when it crossed your path.
No, the coyote's still out there.
Delaware probably would have been taken, but I just have to report it. At the end of the day, that first experience has to be shared. And you know, this is why I love programs like, you know, Ducks Unlimited, like Green Wings program, or like, you know, the great programs that like Wild Turkey Federation has, like getting kids outside hunting. You know, we do a lot with like our conservation education and getting more, you know, kids outside for, you know, other types of activities, and then hopefully engage them to do other types of conservation outdoors, in Ranger Rick or other things. But these are, you know, these are those first experiences, and you have an entire generation right now in the millennials, and you and I are both kind of just on the outskirts of that. But that didn't have those experiences growing up but could be interested for the right conditions. They might have different motives, but if we figure out ways to engage them, having meaningful experience, and you know, I just had my first pheasant hunt. I've done a lot of duck hunting. I've never been pheasant hunting before. Going with some guys that really knew what they were doing, it was a fantastic experience. And for the most part, you know, a couple of the birds were placed, but for the most part, they were native. And it was just a spectacular experience. I only took one bird. I had a guy that's kind of quick on the trigger. I mean, I was a little slow, and I had this one great exchange where, I don't know, I probably shouldn't say this on the radio, but I had a, you know, kind of a perfect shot of the maybe 20, and my safety on because I was so busy, like, kind of watching the situation. So I had to actually get the safety off pretty quickly and then have taken the bird at maybe 60 or 70. And so it looked like the shot of the day because it was kind of out there. So it shows I can at least shoot straight. But I'll remember that. I can't tell you what I watched on TV 2 weeks ago, but I'll remember that shot for the next, you know, 50 years, right? So, I mean, I think there's those kind of experiences that the more people we give access to them, you know, the better off we're going to be, not just for them as individuals, but for the conservation movement as a whole.
And another commonality that we both share is young daughters. And we've learned recently that women are the number one growing demographic of hunters in America. And being able to share experiences that used to be reserved for father and son with daughters is a great example of how things are changing. I think changing for the better. My girls are 10 and 11 now, and one has hunted, has actually taken a turkey on her own. The other one will never hunt. I don't think she'll ever be a hunter. It's just not in her heart. But she likes to fly fish a lot and spend time outdoors. And now we have some rural land down in the Ozark Mountains where we anticipate spending a lot of time fishing and floating and camping and just being in nature. What are some of the things that you do with your daughter? What are some of your great memories so far and plans for the future?
Yeah, so I mean, Riley's a little younger. So Riley's only 4, but she loves to fish. And it's funny, right? The first year, I mean, when she was, you know, she first started going out when she was 2. Probably should have had more of a license for her at the time. I'm thinking about it, but
I think you're safe. You don't have to have licenses for 2-year-olds.
I'm just kidding. You know, the first year, she didn't catch anything. And one time, my father, who she calls Papa, said, you know, did you catch anything? And she said, no, but that's not what fishing's about. If it's about catching, you'd call it catching. And right, and I don't know where she heard that from. I don't think it came from me, but, you know, pretty smart for a 2-year-old. You know, she's learned to set a hook. I mean, she's got the same problem her dad's got. So she's so busy watching everything else that she's not paying enough attention. You know, and she actually got on me the other day saying that we didn't go fishing enough in the fall, which is kind of awesome, right? It's just kind of this, you know, kind of gut check that I got to make more time for it. But loves to hike, loves to, you know, climb on rocks, loves to just get dirty. I mean, she's amazing at spotting, you know, amphibians and turtles and stuff, but she just loves standing and fishing. And, you know, she's got her little pole and, you know, she kind of outgrew she had one of those Shakespeare, you know, kind of the cheap little kind of reels. And, you know, now she's moving on to bigger stuff. And, I mean, she's only 4. I mean, so she's going to have that lifetime love. I mean, we read every Ranger Rick issue together. We do all the activities together, got her outside all the time. And the nice thing is that if I give her choice on the average day between, you know, watching something on the iPad or, you know, some kind of electronic gadget or going outside, 9 times out of 10, she'll choose outside. And, you know, I think that's not the common experience right now. And the average American kid spending 30 to 50 hours a week in front of some kind of screen. I mean, you shouldn't have to be the daughter of a conservationist to have those kind of experience. But, you know, for at least my little piece of the immediate family, we're off to a good start before the teenage years set in.
You mentioned Ranger Rick a few times, and that's a name that's familiar to a lot of our listeners, I'm sure. But for those that aren't familiar with Ranger Rick, would you explain it?
Sure. 50 years ago, the National Wildlife Federation was trying to figure out how to engage kids. And there was a guy named Bob Brownstein, amazing conservationist, who had this idea. He was actually overseas, and he saw this little book that having a kind of a narrator animal kind of lead kids through this book. And so he published this book called Rick the Raccoon's Adventures in the late 50s. And it did well, and they did a couple of other little books here and there. And then over the next, you know, 6 or 7 years, they had this concept of, well, what if we did a wildlife magazine targeted at kids, specifically at kids, and kind of looking at, you know, kind of 6-year-olds to 12-year-olds. And in 1967, the very first issue of Ranger Rick magazine, Ranger Rick's Nature Club, it was called, Nature magazine, was published. And for the last 50 years, the National Wildlife Federation has been publishing Ranger Rick magazine. When we were growing up, there was a younger publication called Your Backyard. Now that's Ranger Rick Jr. And actually, about 2 months ago, we just announced that we're launching a new publication called Ranger Rick Cub, which is targeted for 0 to 3-year-olds. So the idea is that you could have a whole Ranger Rick childhood from 0 to 3. You'd be part of Cub, Ranger Rick Cub, then kind of 3, 4-year-old to like 6 or 7 years old, you'd be part of Ranger Rick Jr., and then 7 to 12-year-old, you're reading Ranger Rick. But they're just spectacular magazines that just introduce kids to conservation. And You know, some are, you know, pictures of exciting animals, some are stories about habitat, some are activities about how do you do help with pollinators or help with, you know, different types of species in your backyard. But the idea about Ranger Rick and the reason that it is a raccoon is that they wanted a species that was accessible to everybody. So rather than using a majestic bald eagle that maybe you see a couple times a year, you know, for the average, you know, city slicker, or bison that may only be seen if you're in Yellowstone or in the CMR, having something that everybody could experience. And, you know, it's funny, when I'm in different parts of the country, people reacted a little differently to raccoons, because a lot of times you see the beady eyes on the trash can, view it as kind of a nuisance. But the vision was that you'd have a kind of a trusted, friendly kind of guide, a guardian, if you will, kind of introducing kids to nature. And we got some exciting stuff planned for his 50th anniversary. We're going to have some great new products, you know, great new books that are coming out. We just released about 15 books that are going to be out there for introducing kids to national parks and different species and just different ways, you know, different activities they can do. And so it's going to be a big campaign, and we're working with our state affiliates in a lot of places to get the magazine more kids' hands. It's one of those programs, like, I don't really want to make a ton of money on it. I just want to get it in more kids' hands, because they even just that half an hour they spend thinking about wildlife could actually light it, you know, kind of plant a seed that could, you know, really just grow into an amazing conservation legacy. And I was writing something earlier today, and, you know, the first paragraph of the essay I was writing was that, you know, when I go to college campuses, one of the first questions I'm always asked by college kids is, why do you do what you do? Like, how do you get into conservation? And I often just kind of pithily say that I was a Ranger Rick kid growing up, and about half the audience knows what it is, and they all clap, right? They all, you know, they all get excited. And there's nothing better for me than when I travel and I'll be talking to these folks, trying to explain what we do and, you know, kind of wildlife, kind of the diversity of wildlife and water issues and public lands issues, this and that. And by the end, I get to say, well, we also public Ranger Rick magazine. And there's just this, I had this great experience. This guy, this, you know, kind of big, you know, 6'4", you know, kind of lumbering guy, and about my height, you know, but probably twice as much weight, looked at me. His voice actually went up more than an octave. And he was just kind of like, I love Ranger Rick, right? It's just kind of this, like there's this, like, youthful exuberance for folks that had it as part of their childhood. And so my goal right now, we got about 1 million kids that are reading it. That could be 10 million if we got our act together. And it's having as many kids have that kind of Ranger Rick childhood as possible. It's where conservation is just part of who they are. And that becomes not something that you learn later. It's just something that's embedded in your being.
It's so important to get it in their hands early, and then to continue that education through adolescence and into early adulthood. And we have a program at CFM called the Conservation Leadership Corps, where we try to train college students on conservation advocacy work. Basically, we let you carry the weight when they're young with Ranger Rick and a lot of these other organizations, DU with Green Wings and so on and so forth. But we're not trying to build professional conservationists. You know, not every one of these people are going to end up in the field. Not every one of these people are going to buy a fishing license. Some of them might not ever go camping, maybe never even hike a trail. What we're trying to do is build a sense of belonging, a sense of ownership into our natural resources across the country. We want to make sure that when situations arise politically, that these people are on our side because they understand the importance of wildlife, wildlife habitat, and standing up for it. A great example is in Missouri this year. We talked a little bit earlier about the Park, Soil, and Water sales tax. And in one of the most contentious election years in the history of this country, you saw 80.1% of Missourians vote in favor of a self-imposed sales tax to ensure our state parks remain some of the best in the nation and our soil and water remains healthy and clean. And I just want to say to you, I know you're putting a lot of emphasis into Ranger Rick. I think it's a very important program, and I'm excited about the direction that it's going. I know you're a visionary, you're a deep thinker, and you're down the road many years. So this 10-year-old right now that's reading Ranger Rick, what does their National Wildlife Federation look like 20 years, 30 years from now?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. And I think on the individual level, I mean, I want to be the organization, both at the state level and the national level, that regardless of why you care about wildlife, I want the, you know, the hardcore backcountry hunter and angler type. I want the you know, the little old lady that's just gardening for monarchs in her backyard, right, with a little milkweed, to feel that there's a place that they can come to do big things for wildlife. And when we've had that kind of diverse conservation army, big things got done. I mean, the unsung heroes in Pippin Robertson, for example, in 1937, it was great to have the millionaires of the Boone and Crockett Club and the the titans of industry that were setting up, Audubon chapters in New York at the time, and these other organizations. It was the boots on the ground. It was the state wildlife federations. It was the garden clubs. It was the ornithological societies. It was the 4-H clubs. It was the forestry associations. It was millions of individual voices. And if you look at the congressional record, there's these great transcripts of how these different groups that didn't necessarily agree on anything, and their politics were all over the place, and they were all different, but they agreed on wildlife. They agreed on the need for proactive, dedicated, funding to do things. 20 years from now, I want to get to a place where folks are saying, these aren't partisan issues anymore. Somehow, because of the work of National Wildlife Federation and other organizations, we actually figured a way to actually heal the country a little bit, and that we show that actually people come together, get big things done, that 20 years from now, that 10-year-old, when they're our age, they're seeing abundant wildlife on the landscape, and not just across game species that we're funding, but across a whole range of species, that we have healthy ecosystems, that we kind of did our part on the climate crisis, but that the natural resources that their kids, maybe 20 years down the road, as they're having kids, are enjoying are as abundant as what we enjoyed, and hopefully more abundant. And the other piece, too, that I think is a little different, I want our cities teeming with wildlife, too. I mean, I want our cities to be, there's a reason why most of our cities are located where they are. It's either the most fertile soil, or it's the access to the waterway, or, places were selected very strategically when a lot of these cities were set up. And so a lot of times they're important places in migration corridors and things like that. But if we do that well, if we have, abundant wildlife on the landscape, both public lands and private lands, we have healthy waterways, we have wildlife kind of cities that are teeming with wildlife, and we have a conservation literate, kind of citizenry. Again, I agree with you, I don't want everyone to be a professional conservationist, but I want folks that are engaged in these issues enough that when, when the rubber meets the road, that they're ready to stand up and be counted. I mean, if we do those things, I think there's absolutely no challenge in conservation we can't overcome. But it's a big, we're competing against some pretty big headwinds to do it, but I'm glad that we're fighting this fight together.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think I've ever met anybody more equipped with all the personal tools to get us there than you, mixed with some of the greatest energy I've ever been around. So I just want to thank you so much for all you do, all the travel you put in. I mean, you're all over the place all the time. You're in high-level meetings in Washington, D.C. You're in a duck marsh in Idaho. You're across the board. Thank you to your wife for letting you go across the country and represent all of us so well. And thanks for sitting down with us today.
No, it's my pleasure. And for those of you that are listening, I mean, you get to hear Brandon's voice on this podcast, and you get to read his words and his columns. But just know that both at the state level, but also nationally, Brandon's one of the most thoughtful guys on these issues. And if there's anything that you can do to support CFM, become a member, get engaged. There's going to be some big fights in the years ahead. I think some folks, the rest of the country looks at Missouri with envy, because you've had dedicated funding, because you've had great leadership. But there's some big fights on the horizon. And if there was ever a time to engage with the Conservation Federation of Missouri, it's right now. So I'm just pleading with you from the national level. We need to keep Missouri that kind of shining city on the hill that it has been, because there's a whole lot of states that look up to what you all do in the Show Me State. And if we can find a way to kind of keep that and grow that and hopefully inspire other states to follow suit, we'll be in a much better place for conservation.
And we're going to do everything we can to get you to convention in March. So for those of you listening that would like to meet Colin personally, put the convention down on your calendar. That would be Saturday night, March 11th.
Can't wait to see it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Good. Thanks, buddy.